You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 12th of January 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and a very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. In the next hour, we'll get the latest on phishing with a PH, how financial thieves are turning their attentions to smaller targets. We'll also hear how Finnish sci-fi films have gone from nowhere to another planet.
Where are we from? Siegfried.
The Earth.
And when did we leave?
Brunhilde. 1945.
Also coming up, who's reading what and where? We'll be talking to the man who calls himself Mr. Magazine. All that plus some great music and a check-in with some of our editors to find out what they're up to. That's here on Midori House, live from Studio One in London. All that to pack into the next 60 minutes. First of all, though, let's get the latest news headlines from around the world with Louise Banbury.
Monocle 24 News with Louise Banbury. Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan is meeting with labour unions in an effort to end a strike over fuel prices that has paralysed the country and now threatens crude oil production. The government and unions with massive public backing are in deadlock over the removal of a popular fuel subsidy, which has spurred tens of thousands of people onto the streets in protest this week. The oil union has threatened to shut down production from Sunday unless the government backs down. Israel's top court has upheld a law denying citizenship to Palestinians who are married to Israelis, with one judge saying it helped the Jewish state fend off national suicide. By a 6-5 vote, the Supreme Court rejected petitions against the 2003 ban, which civil liberty groups said could force Israel's 20% Arab minority who were married to Palestinians to emigrate. Haggai Elad of the Association for Civil Rights in Israel said the legislation was racist.
The Supreme Court's decision to reject our petition with regard to the citizenship law is one of the most disgraceful decisions that the court has made in recent years. It backs racist legislation that will prevent Palestinian citizens of the State of Israel from fulfilling their right for family life.
America has denied being involved in the car bomb attack in Iran that killed a nuclear scientist. Tehran has blamed Israeli and US agents for the death of Mustafa Ahmadi Roshnan, who's the fourth scientist involved in the nuclear program to be killed in a series of attacks. American Secretary of State Hillary Clinton condemned the attack earlier today. Burma's government has signed a ceasefire with ethnic Karen rebels to try to end one of the world's longest-running insurgencies. The government and the 19-member Karen National Union delegation signed two broad agreements to end hostilities between the military and the Karen National Liberation Army and start a dialogue towards a political settlement to a 62-year conflict. The Pentagon said it had no information so far that casts doubt on the authenticity of a video posted online showing what appear to be Marines urinating on the bodies of dead Taliban in Afghanistan. Brigadier General Carsten Jakobsen, a spokesman for the International Security Assistance Force, said the images were despicable.
Any sort of footage, any sort of activity of this kind that is grossly against all the moral values that the coalition forces are standing for are very much working against our course and against against everything that we are standing for and that we're here for. So a thorough investigation will look into the case, will find the ones who are responsible and hold them accountable.
Meanwhile, a Taliban spokesman said although the video was shocking, it would not affect nascent efforts to broker peace talks. The eldest son of North Korea's former leader Kim Jong-il has blasted his ruler brother, Kim Jong-un, as a mere symbol whose role was stage-managed by the elite, according to a South Korean news agency. Kim Jong-nam, who was passed over in the succession line after trying to travel to Japan on a fake passport to visit Disneyland in 2001, is reported to have said he had doubts about how his brother can retain power in the nuclear-armed state. And finally, police in Japan are hunting a prisoner who escaped in the city of Hiroshima in Japan's first jailbreak in over 20 years. Li Guolin, a Chinese national, is serving a 23-year sentence for offences including attempted murder. He's reported to have broken out wearing only his prison-issue underwear. And those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Louise, thank you very much indeed. Time now for a look at the global weather with Thomas Scheffernecker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
And a surge of cold air is heading for Central and Eastern Europe with that snow flurries and some harsh winds. Over the weekend, the chilly conditions will be felt as far south as the Balkans, Greece and Turkey. In Western Europe, it'll also feel colder, but not quite as cold, and there'll be more sunshine from the UK all the way to Switzerland. Here's Friday's City Outlook. In London and Paris, 7 degrees and sunny. In Zurich, 4 Celsius with rain and snow. Prague, 4 degrees with rain showers. And in Athens, it's still 14 Celsius and sunny. How about North America? Stormy weather affecting the northeast of the US and parts of the Midwest too. Rain is falling in Long Island and snow upstate New York and into New England. Also windy with snow flurries for the next 48 hours in Chicago, so check the airport, check Chicago O'Hare. In southern Quebec and in Ontario, also looking snowy, but it's not especially cold. Not now. Here's Friday's City Outlook. Toronto, -1 with snow. In Montreal, 0 degrees with snow, but over the weekend, getting much colder. How about Manhattan? 6 Celsius and rain on Friday. San Francisco, 20 degrees and sunny skies. And a look at some other world destinations. The Middle East, in Doha and Dubai, we're going to see some big swings in the temperature. This doesn't happen all that often. A desert wind will bring highs up to 29 degrees end of the week, but by Sunday, a Gulf breeze will lower it back down to 20. And in China, Hong Kong, a colourful city, but the skies will be grey, rain too, and highs of only 16 degrees. That's it from me. I'm meteorologist Thomas Scheffernecker here on Monocle 24.
And it's 7 minutes past the hour here on Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And Monocle 24 highlights, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, yeah, you're welcome.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Propojalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Our first story today on Midori House deals with an increase in so-called phishing, spelled with a PH instead of an F at the start. Many countries are no strangers to attempts to acquire private information to gain access to secure websites. But now new targets have been identified. To tell us more, I'm being joined by the editor of moneytothemasses.com, Damien Fai. A very warm welcome to you, Damien, to Midori House. Just give us a quick example of a common phishing scam that's currently doing the rounds that many of us might fall prey to.
For listeners in the UK, a current phishing email that's doing the rounds is one from supposedly from HMRC. Now, this email tells the reader that they're actually entitled to a tax rebate, but this is actually fictional. And what it will do is ask them to click through to a sort of fictitious web address and ask for their bank details so they can receive the rebate. But of course, this is all hosted by criminals, and it's just there to try and access people's banking account and usernames.
So that's an example happening in the United Kingdom, but we have a global audience here on Monocle 24. What are the more widespread attempts, the more general trends for phishing?
Generally, it's what they try to do is go after primarily banking details. So I know the example I just gave was for the UK, but what they've actually done is this email's doing the rounds whereby they will use the tax offices in various countries, and they'll perpetrate to be from, in the UK it's HMRC, in other countries it's from their relevant tax offices. And on those emails, they'll have click-throughs for their various banks to say to people, is this your bank? And if they recognise it, click on it and go through. So all they do is it's a lot of similar phishing scams, but what they do is they tailor it for the audience.
Well, when you talk about tailoring for the audience, at the beginning of this item, I mentioned that many countries are no stranger to the concept of phishing, and arguably people in the United Kingdom and the United States are getting more and more wise to these emails appearing in their inboxes. Are there new countries which are being targeted by these phishing perpetrators, these scams?
I think what it is that as countries modernise and they have better infrastructure, then of course they will be targeted just by the number of users that are online, the people using email communication and online banking. So yes, there are increases, namely places. One example is probably India. There's been a sort of a marked increase in India, and that is in part down to the modernisation of people's using online banking and emails. But the awareness among the population of their bank's means of communication, i.e. they wouldn't contact you by email, they'd write to you or whatever, is not actually widely known. So it's a sort of combination of modernisation and also lack of understanding about how your bank works.
So this is actually a question of targeters, people targeting places where they're just slightly one step ahead of the general appreciation of email security. Who are the people who are behind these attempts? Because one would assume that they are from, well, anybody who's actually ever received an email purporting to be from Nigeria or Kenya asking me to give my bank details and passport details in return for countless amounts of money will become quite savvy to them, and one assumes that they're from the countries that they claim to be from, but that's not the case, are they? Who are the main perpetrators?
It's very difficult to say. I'd love to be able to give you an answer to say who they are, but it's very difficult to know where these people are when they're actually making these phishing emails. And because what happens is they actually hijack or they can hijack websites based in other countries. So you may look at the number of hosted websites that are actually being that are part of these email phishing schemes, but what it doesn't actually tell you is where the criminals are. So it's very difficult to say, unfortunately, so I can't answer that one directly for you.
Is it purely a financial scam? Because I read somewhere the other day that a division of the US Department of Homeland Security has issued a warning to internet users after phishing emails emerged yesterday. Attackers spoofing US CERT email addresses to target a large number of private sector organisations. Is it just money, or is it information, secure details?
It's a combination. I think people, they don't just want money, because you're probably your most valuable asset is your identity. Now, somebody could actually get you to disclose personal information, such as address details, dates of birth, all these things to actually replicate your identity. And perhaps that's even more worrying, because for some people, there is obviously a financial loss directly from a phishing scam, but replicating your identity is an obvious second sort of follow-on from an email phishing scam.
So if you can possibly do a bit of predictions, and a bit of predicting, and I know that's incredibly difficult, you have to stay ahead of the people who are staying ahead of the systems. Where can you see phishing going in the next 12 months or so?
I just think it will actually increase in volume. And what they will do is, as the banks try and become more sophisticated, they try and put in these barriers to the phishers by doing text message double checks when you go online. But they can work around these by sort of very cleverly. They're always one step ahead. What I think will happen is they'll probably target different audiences, new audiences, perhaps in sort of developing worlds as much as anywhere else that aren't as internet savvy. So I just think what will happen is they'll just increase in number more than anything, rather than necessarily sophistication.
Damien, thank you very much indeed. That's Damien Fahey, who's the editor of moneytothemasses.com. You're listening to Midori House. It's 14 minutes past the hour. Time now for some music. This is Fabulous Arabia and Give Me Love Tonight.
But you know I wasn't gonna find one. drinking sisters. I want to take him out to lunch. We can have a pot of tea at the Contemporary Lounge. It's the only way that I can finish what I begin. The only way I know what's right. It's a decadent conclusion, a romantic illusion, but I'm doing
And that was Give Me Love Tonight by Fabulous, Fabulous Arabia. In just a moment on Midori House, we'll be catching up with our design editor, Hugo MacDonald, so stay with us.
Every Saturday, Monocle's editors team up with a lively mix of guests to take a leisurely look back at the week past and put out their personal highlights, cultural, political, musical, cinematic and more. Our Saturday show is the perfect accompaniment to the weekend papers and a good coffee. The Review comes to you in association with J. Crew every Saturday at 11 a.m. London time, right here on Monocle 24, and is also available on our timeshift player on monocle.com and on iTunes.
Culture with me, Robert Bound, will make you feel like you've seen, heard, watched, attended and danced to the finest and most exciting events in the world's cultural calendar.
They're like metal, glam, monster band.
They've literally just put some names of pop groups in a bag and shook it.
What is this fantastic place where all these bands still exist?
That's Culture with me, Robert Bound, available all week. Find us at monocle.com or iTunes, download our app and listen on your phone, or just stay tuned to Monocle 24. Thanks for tuning in.
Every day this week on Midori House, we'll be catching up with our editors to get an idea of the latest news in their field of expertise. Today, I'm very pleased to say, it's the turn of our design editor, Hugo MacDonald. Thank you for taking time out of your jam-packed design schedule.
Oh, it's always a pleasure for you, Emma.
It is a pleasure for me. I can honestly say that's a pleasure for me.
It's a pleasure for me.
Oh, that's very kind of you. Well rescued, Mr. MacDonald. What's a big design story this
week?
Well,
the big news in the design world is the London Design Museum has just announced its short list for its annual Designs of the Year awards, and it's a big hoo-ha.
It always is.
There's design awards pretty much every week of the calendar, but the Design Museum, in London is really the biggest. It's the cherry on the icing on the cake. And the shortlist isn't so short. There's 88 things that they've managed to whittle it down to across seven different categories that are fairly predictable. There's architecture, fashion, furniture,
graphics. Does this reflect a general indecisiveness among the design world?
It's not so much indecision as more the fact that design is such a broad category. Mm. And their big aim, the Design Museum, with these awards is to show a complete cross-section of all these different industries.
Right.
I mean, it's transport, it's graphics, it's fashion, it's architecture. There's sort of about 10 things in each category that eventually in April, on April the 24th, a winner will be announced. But, I mean, again, within each of those categories, it's so broad as well. So if you look at, say, architecture, you've got everything from the mega and the sort of huge and press-saturated, like Zaha Hadid's opera house in Guangzhou in China. And then you have something that is completely at the other end of the spectrum, a tiny architecture graduate in London who's come up with an innovative way to use the space under flyovers in London with outdoor cinemas.
It must be very difficult to come up with a winner in that case, because the form and the function must be so very different.
Completely. I mean, it's so subjective. Mm. And this is the big problem they have. And they always come under a lot of criticism every year that really the categories are too broad. There should be clearest of definition of what constitutes product design. Is it a completely new prototype for a very safe bike helmet that is one of the ones this year that looks like a neck brace, and on impact with the ground, it inflates into this sort of complete inflatable head collar.
Let me just have a look. I've been handed a picture of a woman wearing a very beautiful dress, and then on her head, she looks like she's wearing a giant lychee.
Would that be inappropriate? That's not what it looks like the whole time. That's only what would happen on impact.
Right.
When what it is normally is a very simple little collar that, you know, when you fly, it detects very sudden movement. It's a bit like an airbag in a car, and it rapidly inflates and encases your head.
Is it one of those things that when we first saw airbags, we thought they were quite funny, but then we suddenly realised that they would save people's lives?
Maybe it was the answer.
Because I'm looking at that and I must confess, there's a smile on my face, although I do realise that this could save someone's life if they fell off a bicycle.
Well, design is encouraged to problem solve and make you smile at the same time.
What
so I always it's obviously
love
a winner.
About pictures like that is you have this very serious, gorgeous, fashionable, beautiful woman trying to ignore the fact that she has a giant inflatable lychee on her head.
No.
Just thinking, I'm having my life saved here.
Exactly.
Sorry,
exactly.
I'm being so flippant about this design thing.
No, it's fine.
I really suspected that you might be.
But the big thing about the design awards is that, you know, should it be about another beautiful chair, of which there are a few. Here's one of my favourites by Jasper Morrison for
it is a very beautiful, very
Marooney
plain
wood
chair.
Industry. Well, you see, I am a purist at heart.
Describe the chair.
The chair is, it's birch, and it really, if you were to reduce a chair to its most basic elements of being four legs, a very smooth back and a very comfortable seat, then this is sort of what you'd end up with.
And why is this chair different from other chairs?
Because it's reduced to its complete sort of synthesis, but actually it's the story behind the chair that I love. It's by this Japanese family-run wood company that we did a profile on in Monocle last year, actually, based in Hiroshima. They've been making very traditional Japanese wooden furniture for two centuries. And a very forward-thinking young member of the family took over and hired Jasper Morrison, who is one of my design heroes, a London-based designer with a great affinity with Japanese design, to come in and shake things up a bit and sort of design a few key pieces that would then make this family firm go from being a sort of regional star to an international, very well-respected design company, which in the course of 2 years he's managed to do.
Isn't that what design is always supposed to be about?
Exactly, exactly. I mean, there's another wonderful thing here, which is by a graduate from Design Academy, Eindhoven.
Describe it to the listener.
It's sort of like a giant bamboo dandelion, I suppose.
Yes.
The head of a dandelion. Not a dandelion.
A clock. Is it the dandelion clock? Is it?
Once the dandelion flower has gone and you're left with the dandelion clock, exactly.
If I'm wrong on that, I always thought it was a dandelion clock.
Well, this is 40 times the size of that,
yes,
and it's made
and
of
it's
bamboo
not, yes,
by
it is,
an
it's
Afghan
spiky.
Designer called Masood Hassani. And he wanted to address the problem of the several million, 10 million landmines in Afghanistan, where he's from. And what this does is it motors across the land, and when it touches a mine, it explodes, and the mine has exploded and a life is saved. But also it has a GPS tracker, so it can track where it's safe to go in the land.
And you say it's wind-propelled?
Wind-propelled. Which makes it sound a little bit haphazard,
I was going to say, it does sound quite haphazard because, A, the landmine tracker will only go in one direction with the wind.
It's very windy on the plains in Afghanistan.
Right, so it can go hither and thither. Then.
Hither and thither until
but
it finds
But then what if the
mine?
Wind dies down and you have to go and retrieve your landmine?
I think you leave it until the wind picks up again.
Which is a tiny bit of string to it.
The main thing is, I think maybe there are other cleverer ways in which it can be directed.
Yes.
The main thing is it costs $40 to produce.
And it's very beautiful and it's very practical and it's very cheap.
It solves
makes
a problem and that's sort of what the design awards should be about in my mind.
Do you ask, what is the ultimate point of a design award ceremony? Because there are quite a few.
There are many. And the more there are, the sort of less point there is to them. It's sort of, they're killing themselves. I mean, this one, as I started by saying, is probably the biggest in the world. It has a prize value of £25,000 for the winner, which is enough to get a project off the ground, particularly if it's a prototype and if it's a student. And it's nice that actually in the list of 88 things, many of them are student projects. Many of them are just brilliant ideas that could do with a little bit of a leg up in terms of funding. But it's also, you know, it's prestige and it's the press that comes with it. And
do you think that there are any that you would particularly hone in on, or any that you would say
definitely there's Catherine Middleton's wedding dress.
Yes,
no.
Of course.
Which has caused a bit of a furore because everybody's saying this is just the Design Museum trying to get a bit of publicity.
So that's shortlisted?
They're shortlisted. The Duchess of Cambridge's wedding dress. And this is the other thing, is it's been listed as the Duchess of Cambridge's wedding dress rather than Sarah Burton's wedding dress for the Duchess of Cambridge.
Yes. Why do you think they've done that? And also, surely it was the other dress, the Pippa Middleton dress, that caused the more design
furore.
Well, you'd think so, wouldn't you?
Even it's simpler.
I guess in all the sort of controversy of Pippa upstaging the bride, if it was Pippa's dress that won the award, it might be a step too far.
Whether it was the contents of Pippa's dress that was possibly
exactly.
more
Would Pippa's
important.
Dress look so good without
How strange.
Pippa in it?
So you have everything from a royal wedding dress to a very simple Japanese chair.
Exactly. And million things in between. It is a nightmare to try and judge. But
who are the judges?
The judges haven't yet been announced. It's a shortlist of luminaries from around the world.
Oh, right, okay.
And they have the unenviable task of trying to compare these things. I mean, how you compare the Guangzhou Opera House to a sort of small social housing project in Paris is beyond me.
Well, we'll wait and see. That question will be... When will that question be answered?
It will be answered on the 24th of April. And there's an exhibition on at the Design Museum of all of the nominees from the 8th of February to the 15th of July.
So we can actually go and see
So you can go. And actually,
things.
This is the big thing, is the exhibition is fantastic and you get to read about all the projects and the people behind them. So
Hugo, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
My pleasure.
Lovely
Emma.
To see you in the studio again. That was our design editor, Hugo McDonald, wading his way through all the shortlists for the Design Awards in London in the next couple of weeks. It's 26 minutes past the hour. You're listening to the Midori House. And here's Lady Hawk and Better Than Sunday. And that's Better Than Sunday by Lady Hawk. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. In the next half hour, we'll be talking to Mr. Magazine himself about trends on the newsstand. And we'll also be hearing about how a small group of Finnish filmmakers have managed to break into the international market with very little money at all. Before that, though, a catch-up with the world headlines with Louise Banbury.
Thanks, Emma. The US Marines have identified the unit whose forces are suspected of being behind a video appearing to show them urinating on the bodies of dead Taliban in Afghanistan. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has expressed total dismay over the images. Meanwhile, a suicide car bomber killed a district governor, his two young sons and two bodyguards in Afghanistan's southern Kandahar province. Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan is meeting with labour unions in an effort to end a strike over fuel prices that has paralysed the country and now threatens crude oil production. Burma's government has signed a ceasefire with ethnic Karen rebels to try to end one of the world's longest-running insurgencies. America has denied being involved in the car bomb attack in Iran that killed a nuclear scientist, who's the fourth to be killed in a series of recent attacks. Israel's top court has upheld a law denying citizenship to Palestinians who are married to Israelis, with one judge saying it helped the Jewish state fend off national suicide. Police in Japan are hunting a prisoner who escaped in the city of Hiroshima in Japan's first jailbreak in over 20 years. And Iran's president Mahmoud Ahmadinejad said both Cuba-Iranian relations and Fidel Castro were in great shape after he met with the former Cuban leader and his younger brother, President Raul, during a one-day visit to the island. He's now arrived in Ecuador for the next leg of his trip. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, Louise. And Louise will be back in a little under half an hour with a full update of the world headlines. We turn now to the world of magazines. In Germany, they're big on philosophy. In Japan, they're partial to a bit of farming. And the Danes seem quite fond of a bit of cookery at the moment. These are just some of the current trends to be found on newsstands around the world. Well, to examine the world of magazines and why we buy them and where we buy them, I'm joined by Samir Husni. He's the director of the Magazine Innovation Centre at the School of Journalism at the University of Mississippi and self-styled Mr. Magazine. A very warm welcome to Midori House, Samir. So the Germans love philosophy, the Japanese love farming. What are the big global trends in the magazine world at the moment?
Food, and more food. It looks like we are seeing an incredible number of magazines devoted to food, from food combined with celebrity chefs to food combined with cheap stuff to buy, from food that can dissect any category of food, and you'll have at least 3, 4, 5, 6 magazines for that.
This seems to be nothing new in places like the United Kingdom or sort of pretty much around Europe and the United States. But why is food still being held as the big subject for people to print magazines on? Because one can only go so far with it, surely.
Well, mainly because nowadays, I mean, with the trend of eating in more than eating out, we are seeing the influence of television, where we have, the Food Network, for example, in the United States is one of the most watched television networks, and it's 24/7 of cooking and food and making celebrities out of chefs. The same thing is happening with the United Kingdom. The same thing is happening overseas, in Europe and other places, where the celebrity culture have transformed from just like Hollywood or reality TV celebrities to no matter what you do, whether it is in food and gardening and home shows and remodeling and rebuilding, all of a sudden you become a celebrity because we spend more time with you at home in our living rooms, and the magazines are reflectors of that culture.
So you're saying that it's a reflection of a culture. How does a magazine culture reflect a country's mentality or state of, or you know, financial state? And how do trends change from year to year accordingly?
Well, if you believe like I do that magazines are the best reflectors of our society, here in the United States, I can go to any newsstand and I can tell you what type of people live in that neighborhood based on what magazines are sold on the newsstand, whether it is from ethnic, whether it is from economical standards, whether it is from lifestyle standards. You can judge because magazines have their hand on the pulse of a nation. And when the nation moves in one direction to the other, magazines are quick to reflect that change. Take, for example, the United States. In the 80s, when I start first tracking the new magazines that arrive on the marketplace, sex was the number one category. We had more sex magazines published in this country than any other category. 90s, when the internet came and sex took a backseat to crafts and hobbies and automotive and sports. And then September 11 happened, and all of a sudden, the majority of our magazines are back to the crafts, back to the stuff you do inside the home, knitting, quilting, stuff as if like we are back in the 20s of the last century. And now, in the last 3 years, more food magazines have been published worldwide than any other category.
So in many ways, magazines are still all about a fantasy lifestyle that many of us could dream of.
It is the comfort food. You leave the investigative reporting, the in-depth, all the problems of the world to television and newspapers. When you pick up a magazine, it's the me time. It's the time for you. It's either reflecting your lifestyle, influencing your lifestyle, or giving you an escape from reality.
And also possibly projecting an image of yourself by what's on your coffee table.
Definitely, because that's one reason a lot of people subscribe to magazines, even that they don't read. Because you put the New Yorker on your coffee table, you put Monocle on your coffee table, and somebody comes to your house or to your flat and say, like, wow, this is an intellectual person. Not knowing that maybe that person only looked at the cartoons or just looked at the pictures. But it's a status symbol.
So
you can do that with a newspaper.
You were saying that a magazine can offer you a sort of a more flippant approach to life, a sort of a more me time, you say. But explain to me why then the Germans are getting very much into philosophy, which is a very, on the surface of it, quite a dry and incredibly cerebral subject.
Again, but it's like, how can you be more of a philosopher than just looking at the mirror and quantification about everything in life that you want to discuss or approach? The more we become a material world, the more escape we want. And philosophy is one of those escape mechanisms. That's where you can spend 2-3 hours trying to read something about either a spiritual or a philosophical nature that will take you out of this world and all the troubles that surround this world. It's another way of some people get their high from reading about philosophy or philosophical issues, some music, some food, some craft, some sex. It depends on it's you. And that's why like a philosophy magazine will never work in the United States, for example, because philosophy means you have to have a much better attention span. And when you look at our magazines and at our television programs in the United States, and you find out that the average attention span of an individual here is like less than 2.5 seconds. Philosophy will not work here. Not by its will.
You're talking about things that don't work. You have, having been the self-styled Mr. Magazine for a substantial amount of time, let's say. What have you seen come and then go? What's failed and why did it fail?
anything that has to do with politics. I mean, there have been so many attempts to start political magazines that never go anywhere. They publish for a few issues. And again, I mean, we're bombarded by politics. We are sick and tired of politics. And somehow the public have dissected the media and had a usage for each one of these mediums. I mean, to me, a magazine is more like the comfort food. It's more like, I mean, you want something that makes you feel good about yourself, about the world, about your surroundings, about your neighbors. Newspapers, on the other hand, or television, will make you feel like there's crime everywhere, there's killing everywhere, there's this. So by the way the people dissect the media and have that, whether it is manufactured stereotype of the media, I mean, when you pick up a magazine, you are saying, I want something good. I want something that will make me feel good. I want something that will either educate me more, enhance me more, entertain me more. I mean, that has been always the function of magazines.
And finally, to continue on that theme, there's been an argument in the last couple of days in the United Kingdom where the physical attractiveness of the leader of a political party has been examined. I think there was an interview somewhere where the leader of the Labour Party defended himself and said, you know, do you not think I'm good looking enough to be the leader of a party? The fact that magazines combine the physical touch of the paper and the assembly of the word and picture, do you think that a magazine has to be beautiful in order for it to be successful?
Definitely. And it's becoming more and more in this day and age where there is digital competition, when there is television competition, when there's the newspapers are becoming more like daily magazines. I mean, the glossies have to become more of like collector's items. Every issue must have that sense that this is not something disposable. And you can't have something that's not disposable if it's printed on cheap paper or if it's not well designed or if it does not grab your attention. I mean, a magazine today have to be not only food for the brain, but also a feast for the eye.
Samir Husni, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That was Samir Husni, the director of the Magazine Innovation Centre at the School of Journalism at the University of Mississippi. In a moment, we'll be talking sci-fi Finnish film, but first some music. Lights and timing is everything.
Section D is Monocle's weekly design show, hosted by me, Hugo MacDonald. It's a show about the things that we live with, the stories behind them, and the industries around them. From the paperclips on your desk, to the furniture in your home, the shops on your doorstep, to the signs that direct you to them.
What Japan offers up in terms of graphic design and architecture, you just cannot miss it. You have to go.
Section D is about craft, design, fashion, architecture, and graphics in all their guises.
That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24.
We turn now to Finland and its sci-fi film boom. 6 years ago, the film Star Wreck was released and it got a huge audience on the internet. Now, the next film from the same director is being finished off. And it's called The Iron Sky. Before we talk to its director, Timo Vuorenzola, let's get a listen. Let's just have a little clue as to what this film's all about.
Where are we from?
Siegfried. The Earth.
And when did we leave?
Brunhilde.
1945.
Wonderful. And where did we go?
The dark side of the moon!
Brilliant.
Und dann beginnen wir mit dem Meteor-Blitzkrieg.
Right, well, that was The Iron Sky. Apparently it's about, I'll ask the director to tell us more about it. Timo Vuorenzola, a very warm welcome to Midori House. That trailer, I must confess, took me a little bit by surprise. It sounds quite a melodramatic piece of work, doesn't it? Yeah. What's it about?
It's a science fiction comedy. It's about Nazis from the dark side of the moon.
Yeah. obviously. Sorry, I was a complete fool to have let that escape me.
Yeah.
What was the inspiration?
It's basically the inspiration became somewhere in a sauna in Finland. We were sitting in a sauna and a friend of mine said that let's make a film about Nazis on the moon, and it was kind of a good joke at that moment. Then we really started to think about it. We thought that it's a brilliant idea for a film, Nazis on the moon. What could be better? And then we started to develop that, and here we are now. It's finished and it's great.
It sounds astonishing, and it sounds like obviously the sauna is the place where which brings out the creative juices. This is the second film that you've done, and it's all on a sci-fi theme. This is all about the resurgence, or in fact the emergence of Finnish sci-fi. What's the scene like there?
Finnish sci-fi is basically non-existent. I think on the writer front we have a couple of really good science fiction writers, but film-wise there hasn't been any. This is honestly, like, Star Trek was the first science fiction film coming out from Finland, like, ever, and this is the second one. So it's not a big one, but it's not, at the same time, Finland is very tech and kind of a tech-adjusted country with Nokia and all these things. So science fiction and all kind of technological development and advancement kind of things are close to our heart. So at the same time, we have a good audience for science fiction. But it's really expensive to do science fiction, so that's the reason it hasn't been done so much in Finland yet.
You say it's very expensive to do, but what you've done is reasonably low budget on the great scheme of things, isn't it?
Yeah, basically it's... It's a huge like 800 CGI pictures consisting 800 CGI pictures, which is around the same that say any Transformers movie has, but the budget is only 7 million euros. So it's basically made very low budget, but we have a really good and really efficient CG team which we were able to create here in Finland, and a couple of really, really good professionals were able to make it. And also we had a good amount of talent for that. So,
you say 7.5 million euros is a small budget. I mean, that's no small change, though, is it? It's still quite a lot of money. How did you raise it?
It's basically a big amount of money, but very little for a film of sort of this scale. We raised it. It's basically done by sort of traditional means like distribution, and it's a co-production between Finland and Germany and Australia. But in addition to that, we also had the internet people from the internet chipping in. We were able to raise 1 million euros of our whole budget from the internet, which was really important also for the production. So the people, the fans, really helped us out there.
And the internet, obviously, I am assuming, is the key to distribution. Earlier on this week on Midori House, we spoke to somebody from the short films show, the Short Films Festival in London, should I say, and he said that the internet is now possibly the only place that you can get your film distributed, even though people are desperate to get back into the cinema. Is that the case for you in Finland as well?
Well, actually, Ironska is pretty well, the distribution is actually based on film theatres. Basically, the whole PR and the whole advertisement and the marketing takes place on the internet, but the film itself, we're hoping to get it to the big screens. For example, in UK, we have a Revolver distributing the film, and it's coming out in film theatres also in UK in April, mid-April.
So what for you would be a definition of success for Iron Sky? How far and how many people need to see this film before you'll be happy with it?
I'd say I'm happy if 100 million people see the film. Before that, I'm not happy. I think it's good to set the bar high, so there's a lot of room for disappointments. No, but honestly, we're hoping really that this film gets around the world and it gets a lot of attention. It has a very specific idea. It's a very high quality science fiction film, and I think there is audience for that all over the world. So I'm going to be happy to see the film being distributed all over the world. And I think the means for success for me in the end are still kind of non-monetary. The idea is that I hope that this film gets around, and I hope that that means that I get more a possibility to do another big science fiction epic film or television or something, like really, really be able to continue doing epic science fiction films
and
in the future.
Yeah. Finally, we were talking about this as the emergence of Finnish sci-fi film. Is it a one-man emergence of yourself, or is Finland now jumping on the bandwagon and lots of sci-fi films are expected to come out of the country in the next few years?
I wouldn't be holding my breath that we're going to be seeing too much of science fiction films in the future either. But I do hope that it does inspire some filmmakers from Finland to think beyond the facts that we can do something else than just the most typical kitchen drama, that there is actually a possibility to do genre films. So I hope that Finland will be a place for genre films in the future.
Timo Vuori and Sola, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Midori House. His film Iron Sky is widely distributed. If you go on the internet, apparently you can find out where you can see the film about the Nazis who hide behind the moon. Timo, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Vous écoutez Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
Dette Monaco 24.
Essa é Monaco 24.
Das ist Monaco 24.
And a Monaco 24 highlight, yeah.
This is Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
Monaco 24 is your episode.
Tämä on Monaco 24.
The proper Jalavet. Monaco 24.
Esto es Monaco 24.
After I met on Monaco 24.
The head at Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
You're listening to Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
And it's time now to talk to our business editor, Jonathan Openshaw, but not your usual run-of-the-mill editor check-in. Jonathan, fingers crossed, is hopefully lounging with a pre-dinner drink in the centre of Florence. Is that correct, Jonathan?
It is correct, Emma.
Really, what are you drinking and where are you? Tell me what it's like.
Well, actually, disappointingly, I've only got an Astro Zero in hand, but I am in central Florence, which is lovely. And, the beginning of the European Men's Week, so Milan and Paris to follow.
So what have you been seeing?
It's a hard job, but someone's got to do it.
Thank you very much, Jonathan Openshaw, drinking beer and looking at men's fashion so that we don't have to. Tell us about what you've been seeing in Florence.
Okay, so it's for the Pitti Uomo Trade Fair, which is Europe's longest, oldest-running men's trade fair. So it's in its 81st edition now, and it's set in this. So normally for trade fairs, you probably evokes images of lanyards and white tents, but obviously this is done Florentine style, so it's set in the Medici fortress in the middle of the city. It's kind of fitting, actually, that it was the Medici, because it's this kind of centre of old power in Florence, and now it's very much the centre of kind of Italian, it had brand Italy and made in Italy and all the Italian menswear. And so twice a year you see 30,000 of the fashion industry's finest descend on this little old fortress. And it's a really interesting take on the menswear industry.
So what was the mood like this season? Because, you know, Italy and the Medici are always a bastion of Italian fashion and wealth and the wool trade as well. But it's been tempered, perhaps, by the fact that Italy has got itself such a reputation for being a financial mess. Did that affect any of the trade fair this year, or were people blissfully ignorant of the fact that the financial world was falling down around their ears?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, coming into this season particularly, I think there was a lot of concerns, and the domestic market's huge for Pitti. Although it's very much an international event, I think something like 60% of the actual trade done here is with Italian firms and Italian buyers. I had breakfast with the CEO of Pitti, Raffaele Napoleone, this morning, and probably as you'd expect, was very positive about the outlook. He had figures to back up. He pointed to a recent report in La Repubblica, which showed that the exports of menswear in Tuscany rose by 17% last year, and that rose something like 20% for leather goods. So, I mean, they're coming out of a bumper year. It's fair to say that the crisis only really bit here in September last year. I think we're yet to see the full, you know, the full repercussions of what's been happening in Italy. And certainly just looking round the fair, it felt to me like Italian buyers were down a lot. Talking to brands, I think we were getting a similar image. That was being balanced out by really healthy interest in East Asia, huge interest from Brazil, Germany's up. A complicated image, but certainly for Pitti, a tough year ahead if the bottom's fallen out of the Italian market.
If it comes out of the domestic market as well, but there's also the fact that Florence has had this huge heritage of being bespoke artisan craftsmen. Is that anything that's actually remaining, or how is that situation panning out at the moment?
It's kind of impossible. I mean, anyone who's visited Florence will know this, but it's impossible to emphasise enough how much craft is alive and well in the city. You walk down the street, and whether it's, you know, from a kind of artisan gelato maker to a tannery happening on the street to bespoke shoes, it's all happening here. And obviously there's an element of the kind of Disneyland Florence about it. A lot of the things here are done for display. 10 million tourists pass through the city a year, so obviously that there's an aspect. But at the same time, craft is here, and it's taken for granted, I think. And one of the things I actually wanted to talk to you about was I interviewed a shoemaker, Saskia Rittmer, yesterday. And she's amazing. She's from Berlin, trained in Hungary and London, and now lives in Florence, a real kind of cosmopolitan shoemaking on here. And her studio is thriving, and she has enough capacity to take on four apprentices a year, and she's looking to pass on her skills. And she says the only interest she can find in young Japanese apprentices, because young Italians, even though unemployment's up to something like 30% in the region, they're not looking to craft, they're not looking to learn trade. So, I mean, that's a real problem. It's something that the local Tuscan municipality, I think, is trying to work on, but it's not there yet.
It's something that always struck me, that if you walk around the streets of Florence, all the people behind the desks in these tiny little artisan makers are older than one would expect. And yet the great people on the streets, the young Italians, are doing nothing but consume. I always got the impression that the financial crisis didn't even touch them. Obviously, personal debt is incredibly high in Italy, but these young Italian men and women seem totally undaunted. Are they still consuming it the way that they were?
I've been here for a day, so I couldn't speak on consumption patterns necessarily, but I think it's starting to bite. I think people are starting to realise that, you have to be slightly more imaginative in how you're going to do business to get through this. But certainly at the moment, I mean, there's, all the old artisans in Florence, there's a huge amount of knowledge here to be passed on, and people willing to pass it on. And the only people you're having training up in the workshops are, cool young Japanese people who see the value of the craft here and want to take it back to Kyoto or Tokyo, and they're not going to hang around in Florence either. So there is a risk that unless the next generation kind of takes up the mantle, things can be lost.
Jonathan, thank you very much. I've got 10 seconds to ask you. You're off to Milan Fashion Week. What are you going to be wearing for the front row?
I haven't updated my look this season. I feel like my look's timeless, Emma.
Thank you very much. It always is, Jonathan. A beautiful answer to end today's Midori House. It was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Pacheco, and our studio manager was Alex Funnell. From me, Emma Nelson, goodbye.